Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD, my new program we're just getting rolling with, and we're glad you're here as we bring you interviews each week with leaders in and around the Defense Department. Our guest this week is Mary Dixon. She is the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center. DMDC is responsible for a lot of things with regard to DoD personnel, both on the uniform side and on the civilian side. It's probably most well known for its management of the Common Access Card, the ubiquitous CAC card that DoD personnel and contractors carry around and wear all day and use for a lot of different purposes. DMDC also has some major other responsibilities, though. It's a vast storehouse of information of all types on military personnel, and it does a lot of work providing analysis of that data. It handles a major survey program to gather data for military personnel for various purposes and runs the ASVAB vocational testing program, and it handles eligibility determinations for a wide range of DoD benefits. I spoke to Ms. Dixon at her office in Northern Virginia, and we started out our conversation by talking about the decision support role her office plays to military leaders through analysis of personnel data.
We basically have a lot more than just personnel data. So we have casualty data, we have pay data, we have a number of sources. We have personnel security data. So normally what would happen is it's not so much the services, because essentially we're getting the data from the services and we're consolidating it into the one repository of all the data. So we get data from the services, from the civilian personnel system. And what will happen is the OSD, usually the people in the OSD, Office of Secretary of Defense, who are trying to get at some policy or looking at some policy, should we do this or not, will come to us and ask us for information. So if they want to know, for example, one of the things that's been big during the Afghan and Iraqi wars have been, what is the dwell time? So that's a big deal, because how long do people have back at home before they are redeployed? So they can come because we have this contingency data and we know who's deployed. We can tell you how many times people have deployed, what percentage of the force is deployed, where they were. So when we have burn pit issues that came up with respect to that, we could go in and, given the latitude, longitude, we could calculate what units were in that area in any given time. So sometimes it's that kind of thing. Sometimes they're very simple issues. I'm giving a speech, and I need to know how many Hispanics there are in the military, those kinds of things. We also provide data to the research people, so like CNA, the Center for Naval Analysis, or RAND Corporation, who do a lot of studies for the Department of Defense, will come to us and ask us for data.
So it sounds like you do a fair amount of data analysis. You're not purely a data repository, a storehouse for the data that comes from the services.
Correct, because we do understand the goodness and the badness of the data. So we know that there are some data elements, for example, that are not reported by all the services, or we know that some data is not as good as others. And so we're able to then use that. We also are able to get at what is the information they really want. Because you can ask a question, and depending upon how you phrase the question, you'll get a different answer. So we need to make sure we understand how they're going to use the data and how that fits within the data that we have and what would best give them the answers that they need.
So sometimes you get requests for things, and your response back is, well, I think what you're really asking for is X, not Y.
Right. Or if you say, what are the number of officers I have? Well, does that include limited duty officers, warrant officers, or is it all officers or just some subset? So those are the kinds of things that we have to understand when you ask a question.
Let's get into a little bit about identity and identity management. The CAC card, the Common Access Card, is DoD's, as I understand it, implementation of the HSPD-12 card that's beginning to be required across government, at least. First, where's DoD in terms of progress toward checking all the boxes in terms of meeting all the criteria that's required by HSPD-12? Are we completely there yet?
Okay, so the CAC came before HSPD-12. and we had issued that card, and then came HSPD 12. We did have to go back and make some changes to our system, do a little bit of re-engineering, but we had to make sure that it was backwardly compatible with what we were, how we were using the CAC today. So we've completed that process. All the HSPD 12 credentials have now essentially been issued. There are changing requirements with respect to HSPD 12, which I think we'll get into a little bit later, that we are still trying to keep up to date with. But essentially, HSPD 12 and checking off the blocks is essentially complete.
There was a GAO report out that found a lot of the civilian agencies in the federal government were essentially using HSPD 12 cards, or what are called HSPD 12 cards, as glorified government IDs. Without asking you to critique your civilian brethren, what has DOD done over the years, other than sort of being the precursor to HSPD 12, that's enabled it to use CACs beyond just a traditional ID card?
Well, first let me preface this by saying we did not issue cards in the very next start issuing CACs. And then the very next year start implementing and using them other than as a what you would call a flash pass.
Right.
Show the card, there's your ID card, et cetera. Because, first of all, it took us probably 5 years to get all those cards issued. Now we're on a 3-year cycle, so they're replenished every 3 years. But so it's not an easy thing to do. And it's a culture change for some people because it's not really just about the CAC. It's really about public key infrastructure, or PKI, because it's that that really changed the culture. The smart card allowed PKI to be used in the way that they really wanted to, in the most secure way that that PKI should be implemented. But that was the focus. And what happened is that once you had enough critical mass of people out there with those CACs, then the CIOs could come together both at the DOD level as well as the services and could say, we need to push, because we need to secure our networks, we need to push people actually using this card. And so the vehicle that was used to get that done was the Joint Task Force on Global Network Operations, or the JTF-GNO, who put out, as an operational command, who put out a directive that said, if you want to use our network, which is everybody in the Department of Defense, you will have to do cryptographic logon using your PKI credentials, and you will have to complete it by this date. Now, I think all the CIOs understood that there was no way that everybody would make that date, but they had to draw a line in the sand, and then progress was monitored, and then at some point, you know, there was a lot of pressure put on people to get that done. So that's on the logical side, that's how it really got done. And then as people started to use that card and discovered that there were some things that were pretty cool about this, because they not only said you have to do it to log onto our networks, but you have to enable your websites so that they can use the PKI. And now people are discovering that, oh, I don't have to have a user ID and password for the 75 websites that I want to go to and then try to keep those secure. I can use my PKI credential and only have to know my PIN. So I can use the same PIN and the same credential for all of these things. And as critical mass grew, what happened is people started insisting, how come this site isn't PK enabled? I don't want to have to use a user ID and password. And so that put the pressure on the owners of the applications and the web services. So I think it's a thing that you have to start with some sort of, you need to push this and have some directive, and then it almost develops a life of its own and people start demanding some of these kinds of capabilities. On the physical side, we haven't been quite as fortunate, because first of all, to implement something where you're actually authenticating a credential is not inexpensive. And it starts, especially if you're doing perimeter defense, it starts at the gate. So if I don't have any communications at the gate, then it's pretty hard to have some way to authenticate the card. So that's the first step, and that's a pretty expensive proposition. So the services have been focused a lot on trying to get that communications link to the front gate. The Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence has responsibility for physical access policy. And they have put out policy that's very clear that the direction that, that we want to move this department is that in our facilities that we are now able to use to authenticate the credential, not just look at it and say, okay. And not just authenticate the CAC, but also we have a whole other body of something like 10 million credentials for all of our retirees, our family members that are not smart cards that can also be authenticated, although perhaps not as securely. But we can at least make sure that the card is correct. And if I want to check a biometric for the military and the retirees, I can do that. And that is actually being used in places like overseas primarily. So in Korea, Germany, in Europe, and some places in Southwest Asia. And it's growing in the United States, in the continental United States. So that is moving forward, although not as fast as anybody would like to see it. But it is moving forward, and I think over time you will start to see more and more bases that actually authenticate credentials when you show your CAC.
We need to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a minute with Mary Dixon, the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu, and this is On DoD. We're with Mary Dixon today. She's the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center. And a little bit ago, before we broke, we were talking about both physical access using CAC cards, common access cards, and logical access to IT systems. You were saying that getting acceptance for the use of IT, use of CACs, that is, for IT systems, was a culture change. Talk a little bit about why that barrier was a little bit difficult to overcome, at least in the early days.
Well, there was a certain amount of inconvenience, and there were people said, what if I forget my CAC, and then I have to go home and get it because I won't be able to get onto my network, so they had to have that card with them. They had issues of, it was a little bit more difficult because there are some things that are not quite the same as just logging on with the user ID and password. So there was a lot of differences. Trying to get people to do digital signatures was instead of sending pieces of paper. At first, that's difficult because people don't know what to do. But as you get used to it and you become accustomed to it, you start discovering the power of digital signatures. And frankly, a lot of paper that we used to send around to each other doesn't have to be done that way anymore. We can sign documents digitally. We can transmit them right there without having to stop, get a wet signature, copy the piece of paper, send it to someplace else, wait for them to process it through their mail system. It all goes now with the speed of the IT infrastructure. So that is a difficult thing for people to get used to. It's different. You have people that are going, why do I have to have this card? I don't understand. If you have to have a lot of user ID and passwords, and one of the strategies in terms of getting people to more readily accept the CAC was to make the user ID and the password policy more restrictive. So the passwords got longer, you had to change them more frequently, and the more you made it uncomfortable for people to use user ID and passwords, the much happier they were with using their CAC. So there are culture changes.
Now, was that a conscious decision to push people away from users and passwords, or was that a security decision, or both?
Well, it was both. So there is a security issue because you'd want to have strong passwords, but it was also a conscious decision to push people away. You have lots of tools out there that can figure out passwords. So you want to have something from a security perspective that's stronger and more difficult to do. You still have no control over, there's some things you can control when people establish a password. So they're using a word, you can tell that, the tools can tell, oh no, that's not a valid password. But the fact of the matter is that you really don't have any control over what people are actually putting into their password and how strong that password really is, other than forcing rules. But there was a deliberate attempt as well to make it as difficult as possible so that we would move more towards the use of the CAC.
And you said demand increased as time went on. People insisted that that websites be enabled to use PKI credentials. Did that demand come from the CIO community or from the users themselves?
Well, it was interesting because you would go to meetings and somebody would announce they were standing up a new website to do something. And the first question that you would get, is this going to be PK enabled? And that was not from the CIOs. That was from the people sitting in the room that were being told about this new website. And if they said no, they would go, well, why not? And if the response was that we have people that use this website outside that don't have CACs, like, for example, dependents or family members, then the response was, but you can design your website so that it can be used either with a password or with PKI. So we want you to at least do that so those of us who have CACs can use our CACs. So that was a demand from the customers. More and more people, users, are saying, why do I have to sign all these forms, you know, with a wet signature? Why can't they be digitally signed? In some cases, they had to go to the lawyers. The lawyers had to say, okay, for this form, you can use a digital signature under these circumstances. But there was a lot of requests from the user community that said, let's use the capabilities that we have.
Getting a little bit back more into the physical access area, you said again before we broke that there are major cost issues there. Where is this starting to emerge as a solution for physical access to DoD facilities?
Well, there's a number of places. The Air Force has started to, they've embarked on a process to do authentication at their gates in a number of their bases. The Mark Center, for one another, is actually using the CAC for access to that space, not only to the building, but also to the parking lots. So it is becoming more widespread. But remember, that's a new building, so it was pretty easy to build that into the requirements. But you will see more and more of that as you go through. Fort Hood is another example where they actually authenticate the credentials. All the services are moving forward in to one degree or another with some kind of physical access control systems as well.
And what kind of assistance is DMDC providing through that process? Are the challenges really just coming up with funding, or are there technical hurdles that have to be overcome too that you're helping out with?
One of the big things that we are doing is to look, and we've been working with the DIAC, which is the Defense Installation Access Control Group that's run from AT&L and the USDI, the people that have the policy over the physical access. And basically, it's to say what we need is a way to share information among the bases. So let's say we stand up this process and we say we're going to authenticate. Well, wouldn't it be nice if I knew at base A that at base B this person had been barred from entry for whatever the reason is? It could be something as simple as the person has too many DWIs and they don't want the person on that base driving around. So that if you know that information and you can share that with other bases, so that we don't have a person that, for example, in the Washington, D.C. area, tries to get access to one base, like at Fort Belvoir, and can't get access, and so then they drive over to Andrews Air Force Base or to another base, and they get on because they're not using, you know, they don't have that information. So one of the things that we're working with the DIAC on is to try to set up this way to share information among the bases. So that's part of our core competency, is providing that kind of information. The other thing that we are doing is making sure that people understand the interface specifications and how you can talk to the CAC. So we provide test cards to some of the vendors who want to develop these so that they can make sure that it works within their system. So that's another thing. As we start to work across the federal government, there's a real desire to and instruction, direction that says that we need to be able to recognize each other's credentials. Now, in some cases, in some situations, on some bases, it is not simply a matter of you have a PIV card or a federal ID card, or even that you just have a common access card, because that base has other rules that say only certain people can come on my base. And then the question is, if it's something that, that I should know, it's an attribute, like let's say it's one base where you might have to have a security clearance, this would be a very highly specialized place, then we need to be able to share attributes about the person, not just that they have a good credential and that they've been vetted. We want to know more. So we need to have a way to share information across the federal government about those attributes. And that technology and that work is being done by the FICAM group, which is, you're going to ask me what that stands for, the Federal Identity Credential Access Management Group. It's part of the whole federal government effort, and under the federal CIO Executive Board, they've set up some of these groups to try to look at some of these cross-federal agency issues.
So we're a ways away from having this be a DOD-wide, let alone federal government-wide solution for access to physical facilities.
Absolutely. It's starting, and it's starting small, and you'll see it grow over time.
Take another short break. We'll be back with Mary Dixon, the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center, on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbia. We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. And today we're talking with Mary Dixon, the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center. And Mary, I wanted to start talking a little bit more about the idea you mentioned briefly before, attribute-based authentication, which is different from what many of us are used to, you know, account-based authentication, where you log in with a username and a password. Give us a walkthrough of the differences between the two and, you know, the pluses and minuses for DOD.
Okay, there's basically a couple of differences. One, today we have account-based access control. And so when you go to an organization or when you want to get onto a website, you are generally given an account. Somebody has to provision you. So you have to fill out some paperwork that says, I meet all these qualifications and therefore I need to have access. Then they put you into the system, you're given an account, and you're now allowed to access, because they're checking your credential, that you are the person that they gave that access to. It also means that as time changes, when I leave the organization, you should get rid of my account. My account should be deleted. That doesn't always happen, and in fact, there's sometimes are stories about how long it takes somebody to be deleted from the system. Luckily, because they have a CAC, if they've left the DOD and it's been revoked, they won't get into the system because they won't have a legitimate CAC. But under attribute-based access control, what happens is that it's more of a real time. There's no account provisioning. There are policy rules that are established in the system that say, in order to access the system, and I'm going to make these up, you have to be a DOD member, you have to be a U.S. citizen. In this particular place, you have to be a military person, or you have to be a civilian, or you can't be a contractor, or whatever. I am now able to go to any computer, basically, and try to access that website or that network and present my credential, and it goes against the rules and says, okay, so I have to check to make sure this person is a U.S. citizen. So I can hit against the attribute store, which is stored centrally and kept up to date on a real-time basis, and say, they meet that requirement. And therefore, I can have access. So there's an immediate accept or deny. I don't have to have an account, if you will. So it eliminates a lot of paperwork. It eliminates a lot of time. Now, that sounds really great, and I think that's where we're all trying to get to. But there are also, it gets a little bit more complicated as you get into some areas where those, what I would call enterprise attributes, things that we know about people at an enterprise level, are not sufficient. There are things that go further than that, that say, if you're in a special community of interest, so if you're a doctor, is it enough for me to know that you are have a CAC? No, I probably need to know, are you a doctor? What are your credentials, as in medical terms, meaning are you board certified? What kinds of things are you allowed to do? And so it's a whole different set of attributes that you would probably never want to keep at an enterprise level. So the court is out on how hard that's going to be when I start getting down into more fine-grained levels of detail about what I need to know to give you access. And is that easier to do to have an attribute store than it is to simply provision the account. Because every time you provision the account, you're really going through the rules to say, given these boxes that I have to check off, does this person meet it, and then give them an account. Is that take more time than what it would be to maintain those attributes at a central level, at least within the medical community, so I would know the answers?
But on the back end, I guess one of the advantages, instead of having someone have to go in and deprovision that account when someone is no longer supposed to have access, as soon as an attribute about them changes, they're automatically out, right?
That's correct, because the next time they tried to come in, they would not be able to get in because they wouldn't meet the rules. So there's every reason to believe that that will make things more smooth, more secure, more real time, so that I have actual up-to-date information on that individual. But as I said, this is just barely starting, and it's starting on the CIPRNet, so we don't have all the facts yet to really do the final analysis.
So there's really a trade-off, right? You're giving up a lot of work that people have traditionally had to do in administering accounts and putting people into username and password databases, but at the same time, it's a lot of work to figure out what all these attributes are supposed to be and defining those, and every agency's got to do it, I guess, right?
That's right, but I think that in the long run, that probably makes sense, because although it's sort of like doing an HSPD-12 credential. In the beginning, it's hard. But once you get that, and then it's a process of maintaining it. So this is not something that we're going to implement over, you know, the next 6 months. This is going to be something that we are doing some attribute-based access control today, and it will continue to grow, and we will continue to learn from as it grows.
So what's DMDC's role in that entire process? A lot of that work, I'm sure, is being done by various DoD services and agencies, but how in terms of the way you manage identity for the department, what's this changing for you?
So this changes for us in that we have to be able to provide information about those enterprise attributes that we have. We have to be able to do that in pretty quickly. It is not our job to do the policy decision points that are required to make this work, nor to put the structure in place into the application that allows them to do that. It is our job, though, to provide the answers to the questions for where we have data. So is this person military, civilian, reserve, whatever? Do they have a clearance? Are they a U.S. citizen? What is their skill set if we have that information? So those kinds of things that we know, then we have to be able to provide back. And that's our role in the ABAC.
And I guess one of the other areas that's really changing is a lot of the work goes on around trying to build a common interoperable electronic health record with the Department of Veterans Affairs. You need a common identity to do that. What work is going on in that area from DMDC side?
Well, we're really excited about that because this is an opportunity. Everybody, or just about everybody that is a VA beneficiary, started in the Department of Defense. This is a great opportunity to be able to pass information as the person moves from DoD to the VA, and sometimes they're in both at the same time. We are able to then have a common identity. And so there is agreement that we will now use the unique identifier that we use for everybody in the Department of Defense will now be used in the VA systems. Now, how do we get there to a single solution for how we work this within the electronic health record? That still is in the beginning throes of defining that. It's very important, though, that we do that in a hurry, because if this common identity solution is going to be used throughout the electronic health record, then everybody else that's developing their pieces of the puzzle, like pharmacy and the immunizations and et cetera, need to know how to interface with that identity solution so they can find out whether somebody has access to their piece of the electronic health record. So we are under the gun to at least get to the point where we can define that interface requirement for the rest of the electronic health record effort.
And what problems does that solve for the two departments? Is it really just a matter of making sure that the Mary Dixon that's now in VA care is the same Mary Dixon that used to be in DOD?
Well, one of the things that it should help with, because we've just finished having this conversation a couple of weeks ago, is the VA today issues a what they call a VIC card, a Veterans Identification Card. And basically, when you leave the Department of Defense and then you go to the Veterans Affairs to get serve whatever benefits you want, to get a VIC card, you have to start this process all over again. Well, that's really not necessary because we've already done the vetting. So we've talked about how do we pass the information about the individual when the person separates to the VA, as well as their picture that we have on file and their biometric that we have on file, so that they can automatically be given a VIC card without having to go through that process of starting all over. Which should make this much more seamless for our people that separate and then become veterans, the VA clients. The other thing that it does for us is that we have a better way of making sure that we can get at, if you go to the VA doctors would probably like to know about your health care that you got in the Department of Defense.
Sure.
And now we'll have an easier way of making sure that that's the same record and that it is, and that they have access to that. So it goes through your lifetime. You always have that same identity. We don't have to worry about whether the names were different, because it will all be the same as we go through that process. So I think there's a lot of areas where we will see improvements for both the VA and for the DOD.
One more quick break here. We'll be back for one more segment with Mary Dixon, the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. This is On DOD. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. One more segment with Mary Dixon, the director of the Defense Manpower Data Center on Federal News Radio. This is On DOD. Wanted to hit a few more things before we run out of time here, Mary. One is some of the new ways that common access cards are being used and are going to be used in the future. I understand there's a lot of new things that you guys are looking at and are actually doing in the transportation sector.
Yes, we have. This has been a long-term project, because it started with, can I use my CAC? Since it has this contactless interface, can I use it for my transit subsidy that we give out in the federal government? And not only can we use the CAC, but can it be used with the federal PIVs? Now, that's a lot easier said than done. It's a nice thought, but this means working with the transportation industry, because in the past they've all had different standards. So trying to get transit authorities in multiple places in the United States to accept the same kind of interface is one thing. And then trying to shore up the process, because today this is a pretty much a manual process. People line up at tables to get their benefit, and then they go off and they use it. And because it's not really, it can't be very tightly controlled the way we do this today, there is suspected, if not proven, fraud and abuse in the millions of dollars, where people share their transit card with somebody else, or they're going on vacation, et cetera. So the whole idea is to try to, A, get rid of this manual process, to make it more automated, and then to allow you to be able to use your CAC, because that information would be stored in the back end of the transit authority's systems, and then it would deduct as you use it over time. And then you could use your PIV, your CAC card, as you went through the turnstile to use up that benefit over the months of time. So we've been doing a number of proof of concepts. We've done a lot in Utah, in the state of Utah, and it's worked very successfully. We've been doing a lot of talking with WMATA, the Washington Metro Authority, and we're also rolling out the piece, which is the front end piece to this, that has to be done within the Department of Defense, the ability to give that benefit in an automated way and to automate some of the accounting processes, so that hopefully we can eliminate the millions of dollars that we spend every year in not just the people issuing the cards, but if you think about all the people that took time off from work to go stand in line, they could be back at work actually doing their work. So that we're really excited about. It's probably a couple of years away. We're hoping to be able to run a small pilot with WMATA in 12 or early 13, so we can do the pilot, but then it'll be dependent upon whether it works or not. We can do the proof of concept, but then actually making it work will depend upon what WMATA's schedule is for upgrading their system so that it can do this. So those are things that we're working on today and are actually starting to come. It's like I keep giving my staff a hard time because it's like, so when are we going to see this? Because it seems like we've been working on it forever. But it is a lot of hard work and a lot of coordination and trying to get the transportation industry across the country together to agree on a single standard has been a huge.
And that's been such an issue, I know, even for just local transit agencies, because there's proprietary standards out there. It's hard for, you know, cooperative organizations to even get the buses and the trains to, in one local area, to all use the same technology. Is there a chance that as DOD starts trying to roll this out, that it might be able to drive some standardization across the industry there?
Well, as a matter of fact, I think the industry has come together in some respects and can actually has started moving in that direction. So there's a number of them that have all agreed to a standard interface that they're going to use. So I don't know that it's because we drove it. It would be nice to think that it was because of that. But I think it's to all of their benefits to try to move in that direction. Because the more you can drive to the standard, if you need to change out your system, you're not dependent upon proprietary solutions, which means you have to change out everything in your system as well.
Another area of the transportation sector I know you're working on is with the Transportation Security Administration. You're just about to start a couple new pilots there with authentication, I guess, at airports, right?
Yes. This is as you go through the line to get your credentials checked. And so what we're going to do is a pilot that says, and we're going to have it, they're going to have a connection to our system that will allow them to authenticate a CAC for our military members, which should help to expedite their way through that part of the process. We'll roll out as a proof of concept a pilot in Monterey. Given that everything works the way that we're hoping that it all works, it will move to Atlanta in December and then to San Antonio in January.
And another thing we were talking about off air as far as expansion of the use of Common Access Card is possibly some of the things you're looking at are expanding those to the large pool of retirees the DOD has, right?
Right. So there's been a lot of discussion over the years about couldn't we issue smart cards to retirees? The question has always been, of course we can. The problem is that it's a lot more expensive than what we do today, and is it affordable? Given the fact that most of our retirees and family members are primarily using our networks or our websites for self-service, do we really need that level of security? Well, in an effort to try to get more information about what happens when I give a PKI credential to an individual who doesn't have an IT shop to help support them, how to install the middleware so that you can use the card, how to install the reader that you would need to have on your computer. We're running a small pilot with the Army that is short term and will run through March of next year and will be limited to 2,500 people. They will not be getting, it is not an ID card. It is a smart card that they can use for logical access. So to the Army Knowledge Online or to TRICARE Online or wherever they go where they're getting self-service today. And the idea is to see, A, how does it work when they try to use this in their home where they're the only IT shop they have and may not have a lot of IT background. So we're going to be collecting data on that. It will be rolling out in about 5 locations in the Army. Again, very tightly controlled in terms of how many people can do this. So at Fort Belvoir, Fort Bragg, Fort Gordon, Fort Hood, and Fort Jackson.
And any other big things we should be watching for out of the Defense Manpower Data Center as the months and the years ahead go? What are your largest priorities coming up here?
Well, I think our largest priorities for this coming year are focused on, one, the work that we're doing in the physical access community about trying to do the information sharing across the bases. Another one that's huge is our work in identity with the electronic health record. That's another one of our big ones for this year, as well as the attribute-based access control, trying to get that rolling in terms of the more users and better capability. And in our other area, which is not really identity, if you will, is trying to develop a more robust analytical capability for our decision support function. So how can we share more of this information? How can we integrate some of the information that we already have, but we now tend to do in stovepipes? So we have personnel survey information, which is more opinion-based, and we have record-level data. And wouldn't it be nice if we could do a better job of when somebody asks a question about suicides, if you will, or about retention, we can not only tell you what the facts are, but we can also tell you something about what our people are saying today about their retention intentions. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to work on building, and those are our keys for this year.
Lots of interesting developments around authentication, around identity here at the Defense Manpower Data Center. Our guest has been Mary Dixon. Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.